So we tell them that nature is a source of life. It's not a resource, you know, that you grab and convert into some product, distribute it, exploit it, and destroy it. Persons with disabilities are part of human diversity. I would like to broaden the scope and say that persons with disabilities and human beings are part of species diversity.
Welcome to Enabling Commons, a place for conversations with activists, experts, and scholars at the intersections of disability and climate change. The podcast is produced by the Disability Inclusive Climate Action Research Program based at McGill University. I'm your host, Anya Kelly-Costello. Today, I talk to Pavan Mundla, who is an experienced climate resilience trainer from India. Pavan works with farmers, including farmers with disabilities. In our wide-ranging conversation, Pavan holistically describes the connections between how we tend the land, our well-being and livelihood, and planetary health. Let's dive in. I'm speaking with Pavan Mundla. Welcome to Enabling Commons. It's so lovely to have you here, Pavan. Could you start off by introducing yourself for us?
Sure. Thank you. I'm Pavan Mundla, and I'm from India, and I work with regenerative agriculture, which is natural farming here, the name which we have given to that. And I'm a climate resilience trainer and work with communities. And I live in Andhra Pradesh in South India and on the Eastern Ghats, on the foothills of Eastern Ghats. So we help farmers to understand values of natural farming. And what I mean by natural farming is a farming that would not use any chemical fertilizer or pesticide, do not even use any seeds purchased from market. We promote farmer self-help groups with women leadership. And through that, we collect seeds and help farmers to distribute these seeds among themselves. And broadly, it is called integrated natural farming based on agroforestry models.
Thank you so much for that overview. And we'll get a little bit more into the detail of that soon. But I just wanted to go back because your organization, the Svatikar Center for Disabilities Information Research and Resource Development, started back in 2004, I believe, and originally had much more of a sort of general human rights focus for people with disabilities doing training in that area. And now you've zoned in on climate justice and climate action by upskilling farmers with disabilities. And I wondered if you could explain why this was an important shift for your organization and how you set about orchestrating that transition.
It's a wonderful question. So really, it is not a shift that I think. It is only a scope that we have incorporated into the human rights discourse because general human rights, we look at civil political rights, economic, social, and cultural rights. So once if the climate change start impacting lives of people, in fact, which is already impacting lives of people across the globe, it is inevitable that there is a need for changing or resetting our goals of life. You know, when I say goals of life, broadly, I consider the way we understand our civil political rights, economic, social, or cultural rights needs to be understood in the lines of the climate change and the impact that is creating on our economies locally, nationally, regionally, and internationally. So that is the broader perspective which I have in my mind when I say that we need to relocate our rights in light of climate crisis that we are experiencing today.
Yeah, thank you for pointing out that reframing, because it is so important to recognize that existing rights are all under threat because of climate breakdown, and that a key way of upholding rights intersectionally is giving people more livelihood opportunities, as you're doing through your programs.
Yes.
Yeah. As a blind person myself, I'm aware that it's really quite unusual currently for blind people to be working in the ecological and land-based policy area, which you're focused on as a blind person. So I wondered how you found your footing in this space.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful. See, it is a kind of a transition from academics to agriculture. In fact, that kind of a transition is has happened to me and my family because of our constant interaction with global academic discourses, wherein, you know, at that time, I think in early 80s and 90s, many third world countries are exposed to globalization as well as the first world countries. So in the process of the globalization, privatization initiatives of the world, most of the decisions are taken by the business establishments. You know, we started looking at the MNCs intervening into the investments in industry as well as in agriculture. So at that point of time, we were worried about the farmers' rights, basically the land rights and their crop patterns and the impact on their indigenous knowledge systems, inheritance of various traditions and cultural values and their spirituality. We thought that these things will be a threat when global initiatives are impinging on our basic survival. So luckily for us in India, there was a decision by the government itself that foreign investors cannot purchase land in India, particularly they cannot purchase agricultural land in India. But still, by then, there are these farmer suicides happening across the country because of conventional farming, which is basically a market-driven green revolution model. So that in fact initially gave a lot of yields and farmers prospered to a certain extent, but slowly and steadily we experienced deterioration of land and coming down of yields, and investments in agriculture sectors become very high, and farmers slowly started moving into high pesticide use and high chemical use, to thinking that, you know, there will be an increase in yield and so that they can get better price, because of the marketing technologies changing over. So that was the scenario that really disturbed many of us studying in universities in those days. Then we were looking at alternates, that, you know, at least 60-70% of the population in India are invariably associated with the agriculture sector and they live in rural areas. And if you just disrupt their traditional system of agriculture, which was a major source of their livelihoods, they will be forced to migrate into the cities for other business establishments like real estate and laying up roads and, you know, all these things. And then at the same time, slowly and steadily, India is also exposed to IT sector in a big way. So for these things, for various reasons, somehow local governments could not establish such training centers to enhance the skills of the younger generation who would find it difficult to suddenly migrate into cities and look at opportunities of employment. That is one side of the story. The other side of the story is these young families who were compelled to move to the cities because of the problems they ch and challenges they face with the agriculture. They go there only as laborers because their skills are not fit into the industry that is growing and on the urban side. So, and they are invariably exposed to their children to a kind of poor habitations and the lack of facilities, like basic health care was a challenge, education of children was a challenge, and their transport systems were a challenge, and their housing was a great difficulty, and their security, basic security for women was a threat, and a lot of exploitation has started happening. So given these situations, we thought that relocation of farming communities in an urban setup is not an easy thing unless the industry looks at that in the perspective of so-called rights. They would not really address those issues as part of the national policy or state policy. And, you know, even if you have policies in place, who will understand that language and how does they really access those policy language and the conditions that policy set up, and how does one really adopt it and start fighting for their rights? Because most of them are illiterate in many ways. Literacy doesn't necessarily mean, you know, access to reading or writing. It means access to laws, access to legal systems, access to courts, commissions, and various things. So we have seen people really entangled in a critical situation which they have never thought of in urban areas. And in such situation, life of persons with disabilities who are either languished in villages without their siblings or parents, or would move along with the parents to urban areas where their human rights was in a jeopardy. So this was the real reason behind us, you know, moving from city to rural areas and looking at these experiences of people. So at that time, we came across with the idea of regenerative farming. The challenge was that these initiatives did not really see the value of a traditional knowledge system in a holistic way. So my opinion here is that when you look at farming, you will have to see it in a holistic way, because it is not just a land and, you know, some seeds you sow and put some water and use some fertilizer or pesticide. And if these plants grow, no, it's not farming. The farming is about, you know, how you really use your experience inherited from your predecessors, and then identify such best seed varieties, and then move into a kind of farming profitable to the farmer, to his health, to his family health, to the health of his entire village. And then when you look at integrated agroforestry system, definitely you will have animals like cows and buffaloes in India, for that matter, which will be integrated into the farming. Yeah. Agroforestry doesn't mean monocropping. It is a form in which you will have several seasonal trees, bushes, creepers, crawlers, vegetables, pulses. You know, each plant will contribute to the growth of other plant and the nutrient exchange. With that, you know, you have several types of plants in a farm, which will give us yields all through the year, and in between spaces we will also promote these seasonal annual crops for their food and well-being. And we thought that in the process of a natural farming, we will take care of their culture, their traditional knowledge systems, and then we bring in all these aspects for providing a prosperous platform for farming. So that is how the whole pattern of integrated agro farming has taken up as a model, and I got expertise in that because of my association with various other practicing farmers in Andhra Pradesh in those days.
Was this back in the early 2000s?
Yes. We just adopted it in 2010, but no one knows about it. So
And
when you
not
think,
for people with disabilities specifically either, right? Like you were just
yes,
starting that
yeah,
when you're,
it was
yeah.
not, yeah, it was not disability specific farming initiative, never. But definitely, there were some persons with disabilities who were involved in this process. So we must understand one thing very clearly here. You know, farming is not an individual activity. Like our employment or livelihood systems that we have here, the farming is never an individual activity. It's a collective activity, like entire family involves in it. And in fact, you know, these families together share a lot of knowledge and experience.
Thank you for giving the context of how how the conventional farming models were, but also the effects of things that were maybe more visible before climate breakdown and which were also causes in themselves in some ways. So globalization also came with market-based economic models, right? Like neoliberalism. And then yeah, as you were mentioning, the ways that people were being pushed into cities, and so all those effects on livelihood. I think that's a really important like context. The effects on women's rights, the erosion of indigenous knowledge systems, and I think that links really nicely to understanding like climate breakdown doesn't just come from nowhere, right? Like it comes from these things, and it has these effects on then how people live, and then needing to be kind of. Would you say like knowledge brokers in your role of being able to pass information along? And I think the other really powerful thing there is like, I think it's really easy to like stay in one place as an academic, right? To be like, okay, I'm going to write papers on this. But obviously, you've played a much more hands-on role in knowing both the sort of the high level policy and laws of rights, but also the quite detailed understanding of exactly how, which strategies can farmers be using to like be profitable, but in a way that is also really sustainable for the planet and healthy and collective.
Yes.
That's incredible. I wondered what are some of the outreach strategies that you use to identify current or potential farmers with disabilities?
Yes, we have identified potential farmers with disabilities, and many of these potential farmers are part of the government program which we have initiated in the year 2001, 2002. In 2015, it is transformed into community-based natural farming in Andhra Pradesh. Now it is called Andhra Pradesh Community-Based Natural Farming, in which persons with disabilities are also identified and integrated into these models. And both men with disabilities and women with disabilities are coming in, and I'm one of those resource persons who does a lot of training to these people. And at the same time, I do a kind of a disability specific training. At the same time, I do general training. So like, I don't want to see persons with disabilities in isolation in this entire practice, because any farming need people. You know, it is a collective action that families get involved in farming practices. So if there is a person with disability in a family of four or five, all of them take different responsibilities at different times. I have seen persons with disabilities, for example, helping the woman in the family to identify best seeds and process them and keep them for next plantation. That is one activity I have seen from persons with disabilities. The other activity I saw is that they help the sowing of these seeds. They go to the farm with their parents or laborers, and they help them in sowing the seeds. And I have also seen persons with disabilities taking these animals for grazing, cleaning them, feeding them, milking, and protecting their calves and looking after their health, bringing these doctors and checking them up, and then packaging the whole thing of milk and then sending it to the markets and all that. And I have also seen these guys in food processing. So once if the yield is out, you need to process it before you put that in bags and then send it to the godown or where they really store these food items. So these are the various activities that they does.
This is all super great because I think a few of the things that you touched on. One is, as a disabled person, I think being able to offer trainings to people with disabilities, but also farmers in general, and specifically people with disabilities within their family context that they're going to be like working in, is really important and powerful.
Yes.
And that kind of leads into my next question then, which is, what sort of adaptive measures do you draw on to kind of meet the needs of people with disabilities that your organization is training? And kind of related to that, I'm interested whether you have advice for more, you could say, mainstream organizations who are maybe training farmers, but not necessarily working with farmers with disabilities yet.
Yeah, that's a major gap that we find in this whole training. I must explain the problem that and the real challenge that all of us face. See, there is a vast difference between rural area and urban area. Most of the disability sector, for that matter, and particularly the guys like me, articulating our views or sharing experiences in English. You see, we are all in a way urbanized, and then our demands are also totally urban centered. If you see the United Nations Convention on Rights of Persons with Disabilities closely, okay, it doesn't really look into the livelihood needs of persons with disabilities in rural areas and the challenges they face to access all human rights for that matter. So there is no specific mention about that. Okay, so that is the gap which in fact penetrated into the heads of those who are in those who are working from rural areas. So, for example, when I was in the city, my demands as a person with disability was totally different. But when I moved into the rural areas, I started looking at the real conditions of life where majority of the disabled person, at least in India, 80% of persons with disabilities live in rural areas. So their capacity is the inherited knowledge, and that knowledge is centered around agriculture. So that is something which we used as a source to train people with disabilities along with others. But still, we experience this knowledge gap between intellectuals from intellectuals emerging from rural areas and intellectual coming up from urban areas with a kind of a global knowledge system, so-called global knowledge system. We will have to negotiate between these two spheres because people who are in villages need a livelihood system that is accessible to them. Okay, but those who migrate into the urban area, they will have to adopt, whether they like it or not, some systems which are accessible to them as part of their livelihoods and sustenance. So we will have to maintain this balance, when we offer this training. It's mostly not about the tricks of the trade. It is all about mindsets. That is giving posing a lot of challenge to us. But however, the question here is, when we do these trainings, we give them a comprehensive knowledge of what climate change means and what inherited knowledge means and what sustainability means and what all these things really impact their livelihoods. In when you see livelihoods in relation to the other species, that is where I have seen a major shift in the approach. When they realize that unless these animals, birds, microbial populations, our water systems, air, and drinking water, irrigation water, all these things are protected. It is impossible for human beings to survive. That's the crux of the whole game, particularly in farming. let alone the carbon sequestration, emissions of greenhouse gases. These things could be handled by maintaining the farm in an integrated agroforestry system, which will really help us to save our soils and say, keep soils away from soil erosion. And by doing away with chemical farming, we will not be contaminating our water or air. We will not be contaminating our plants, and we will not be contaminating our food. In fact, we will produce food in a very sustainable way and give nutrient food to human beings and also to our animals, birds, and insects. Like, main business could be the agriculture and farming in the agroforestry model, integrated agroforestry model. But alongside of it, there is a scope for a lot of ancillary industry in terms of food processing, marketing, value addition, and some of them will start these small shops. We call them as input shops, where they make these bioinoculants, organically prepared pesticides, and they distribute them to the farmers. And then there is a new way of a new way that has emerged into the villages, where they use locally made tools which were used traditionally, and also add some technology to that. And they create these new implements and also start these small repair shops for the maintenance of these instruments. That is how we bring in several aspects into this farming, and several persons with disabilities are getting livelihood opportunities.
Thank you. Yeah, I think you touched on so much there. Like, the important question is about the context. So firstly, we're in the rural areas. Next, it's like a question of what do livelihoods actually look like in a changing climate within those areas? At a family level, what does it look like to preserve Indigenous knowledge and connect that with actually like the farming systems that are being used? How do you carry out that training? And then in there somewhere, it's like, okay, there are people with disabilities and there are people who don't have disabilities, and just finding ways to make it work, I think, is what I'm hearing. Tell me about some of the initiatives you've carried out to promote and facilitate opportunities for women farmers, and particularly women with disabilities.
Yes, on one hand, women farmers are stressed out at the household work. Mostly these communities in Global South are really going through the patriarchy kind of a model, where rights of women are already suppressed, and they are being subjugated and exposed to all kinds of violence. So while confronting the violence, they are now getting exposed to these hard work at home, raising up children, raising up animals, and then supporting their husbands and sons in their farm. And then they eat very less. They are bound to feed their families first. That is something is very very bad in our societies. Now women are alert and they are coming together as groups and understanding these things. And thanks to the intervention of feminism in India and other parts of the world, women are now realizing the rights, and they know what they are, how to access the various legal systems in the context of violence. And many laws have come, but still, there is a lot that women need to do. So there is a greater role for women and women with disabilities, who are equally important in family, and alongside of the realization that their location is very important for them, and their integrity as human beings or as species is interlinked with the life around them in their own village or in their own township. When we do the training program, in fact, we initiate the training with various knowledge systems, and having the baggage of various knowledge systems. But what we do is, when you get into the training, we put them in groups and pose these questions, like, what are the good practices that you have in farming?
I'm guessing, women farmers have had a lot less access to this knowledge and to this training, given the other demands that are placed on them and given the sorts of violence surrounding their lives, as you've mentioned. So is that about sort of specifically making sure that that women also, you know, are sort of, there's the outreach and the targeting there to make sure that this knowledge is getting through to them as well?
Yes. What we do is we go for house to house visits and tell them about the objectives of organization in line with natural farming, and we will also identify the best farmers in that area, and we introduce them as trainers, and we organize these exposure visits to their fields. This is all done before the training, actually, or sometimes as part of the training. So we will take around 25 to 30 women, or, you know, farmers, persons with disabilities, everybody together. So we'll take all of them. And, you know, the total number should not increase, you know, should not go beyond 25 to 30 because of various training skills that we have adopted down the line. So we restrict that. And then we organize these group discussions. Like, we don't put all women in one group, or we don't put all men in one group. It's a kind of a mixed group with persons with disabilities, so that, you know, make them understand each other's challenges in many ways, like in terms of knowledge, in terms of access, and about the violence and other things. You know, there will be special sessions for that. You know, most of the trainings are 3-day trainings or sometimes week-long trainings, and which include, you know, training on lifestyle. You know, what kind of clothes that you buy? Are you buying these clothes from market, or are you going to your weaver? Because, you know, it's all integrated kind of stuff. Are you buying steel parts or clay parts made in your village? Are you buying these agriculture implements from market, or local vendor? You know, where do you go for your maintenance of your implements, you know, and what kind of jewelry that you wear? Where do you buy? Do you buy them in market? And how do you really get your cosmetics? Are you make them at your home? You know, taking the indigenous knowledge that you have inherited. And we also talk about their cooking, you know, what are the types of food that you make at home? Is it something, you know, drawn from your ancestors, or is it something that you read in books or, you know, cookery shows? If you look into the sources that you have in your own village, you know, depend on your weavers, your pottery, your, you know, goat traders, sheep traders, your buffaloes, your milk, you know, your food. If you depend on that, you know, you will be contributing to the economy, and you will be part of the circular economy of the village, where slowly and steadily you would realize that your village is becoming self-sustainable, and you are very much protected, and your interests are taken care of, and you are respected for initiating these things.
That's really powerful, because I think there's a couple things there. One is, like, I'm reflecting on sort of when we were talking about gender before, and I was kind of asking you, you know, like, which initiatives are particularly making sure that women are included and empowered and whatnot. And I think that the way that you responded to that also really points to, like, if you are understanding the context in which they're living, and the other factors that are, you know, part of that fabric that you've explained. And the same for people with disabilities. Like, if you have a holistic understanding of that, and are able to cater to that within the trainings, then that is in itself a way of people being able to connect with those trainings and those knowledge systems. And then the other part that I think is really interesting is transitioning back to those indigenous knowledge systems and more local ways of doing things, which I think, like, on the one hand, we think about, like, not wanting to say to, you know, to disabled people or people who are poor or not, like, oh, you need to make this particular lifestyle change in order to combat climate change, because really it's, you know, it's all the corporate polluters that are causing climate change. But on the other hand, like, if you frame it in the sense of actually, like, how would you feel most integrated and most, like, well-positioned where you stand, you know, like within the rural village, what does it mean actually to be closer to the land? Like, that is a grounding that's really powerful, right? Because that's going back to the fact that, you know, Indigenous people are guardians over, I think it's 85% of biodiversity. And, you know, if we were actually able to let Indigenous knowledge systems thrive and return lands to Indigenous people, then we would not be in the climate breakdown situation that we're in.
And the most important here is that one is not interested in romanticizing their life. You know, they also have, you know, faced a lot of challenges in sustaining their life. And, you know, if one were to say that, no, you go back to nature, you know, like, you know, bring these knowledge systems from other parts of the world and read, and tell them that you go back to nature, and you suddenly, you know, tell them, oh, okay, you know, the education that you send your children is not really worth looking at. You know, you stop this you know, stop your children going to school. You know, if you say all these things, they don't listen to us. So, and it is not right on our part. So what we do is we will only, you know, provide them these choices, you know, whether you want this side or that side, it is up to you. So, you know, I have seen several of my friends and their children, you know, working abroad and working in cities in India. You know, they are finding ways of reaching out to the villages now. They are buying land, agriculture land, and they are going for these agroforestry kind of types, integrated agroforestry models, both persons with disability, women, and also these men, you know, young men and all of them. And those who have completed their 40 years of age or 50 years of age are looking back, okay, where did I come and why am I continuing this life? Anyway, these, you know, these livelihoods are not sustainable. And, you know, this lifestyle is not really necessary. It is only hazardous to the health of my family. So they are realizing these aspects and they are looking, you know, opportunities to go back to the villages now.
Yeah, and I think, you know, all of what you're saying speaks powerfully to the impact of your work, which I think, if I'm understanding, a lot is about giving people the options of being able to move back or remain in rural village settings, but in ways which are really holistic and sustainable, and both, you know, both in terms of planetary and ecological well-being, but also for their own livelihoods. So without forcing them basically into that sort of urbanizing lifestyle, which they may not have really chosen at all. It might have just been, okay, well, economically, I feel like I need to be in there. Employment opportunities wise, I feel like I have to do this, right? Was there anything else you want to say about sort of the impact that you're witnessing that, you know, your work is having?
You see, the kind of questions not now I receive from our community is, you know, is it really worth it to invest huge money in urbanization? So more money leads to privatization of resources, in the sense that more private wealth leads to more exploitation of nature. And, you know, what they do, see, they buy new houses, furnish. You know, buying new houses means you destroy mountains, you destroy your water resources, you destroy your trees for your furniture. Okay, you just erode, you know, landscapes out of shape. And then you expose all that to, you know, radiation and, you know, accumulate heat into that. So what is it that we are doing in the name of real estate, in real terms? Is it really worth it? So, you know, we will not pay for that. This entire game ultimately end up in promotion of private wealth, which leads to exploitation of nature. So, and we also, you know, get questions like, is nature a resource or a source? So we tell them that nature is a source of life. It's not a resource, you know, that you grab and, you know, convert into some product, distribute it, exploit it and destroy it. You know, nature is not that, you know. And then the questions that we also receive are very critical sometimes, like, you know, it's end of the day, human population is superior to other species. Then we say, as per the latest understanding in at least ecological sciences, they say that human population's percentage in the universe is just 0.7%, 0.7. Okay, and rest of it is in life, like your trees, your mountains, your water, okay, your minerals and metals and your air, your trees, your birds, your animals, your microbial populations, etc., etc. We depend on each other in different forms, and we cooperate with each other.
I think what your work does really powerfully, and if I had to think about what the impact would be hearing you speak about it, is that you're really interested in changing people's mindsets and like having the big picture, but also the detail to be able to go in and actually, you know, run programs and, you know, keep involved with those communities and those collectives in order to actually be changing practices at a really deeper level.
The last point for you, persons with disabilities are part of human diversity. I would like to broaden the scope and say that persons with disabilities and human beings are part of species diversity. Okay. And then, you know, you have, when you say that we are part of species diversity, we could see that, you know, the major difference among species is about their mobility and communication, right? So we are, as persons with disabilities, we were deprived of, because our difference in sense perception, communication, and our mobility, you know, and then some various health differences, body shapes, our heights, like color and gender, you know, these are the things which, in fact, you know, either discriminated us and then assimilated us into the system and, you know, accepted as per the human rights discourse as part of human diversity. But if you take the larger part of species diversity, you see that there are several trees with different sizes, shapes, and different spread and different rooting system. Okay, and then penetration into the soils, consumption of resources of nature, like rivers, you know, there are different sizes of surface water, groundwater, and then you go for these mountains. You know, there are different climate zones in which you see different kind of rocks and rock formations. So in that way, you know, human beings are a part of that larger, diverse ecosystem. Okay, so if you take that larger part, I think persons with disability should, you know, use up these, you know, horizontal thinking for a kind of intergenerational approach.
Like making an ecological model of disability. I don't know if
yes.
that already exists.
Exactly.
But,
yes. You are absolutely right. Yes. Yeah. It has to be an ecological model of disability. You know, the traditional human rights model or our social models, you know, I'm not denying that. They will give us good language and, you know, articulate our rights within the framework of our constitutions or, you know, our aspirations. You know, but we will have to elevate from those narrow paths. You know, for example, even science or human rights science, for that matter, really gives us a very narrow scope. You know, it will never give us a holistic scope. There is something called a holistic view, which bring all these things and also integrate the environment and a kind of an ecological way of finding our existence and, you know, work towards restoration of ecological systems.
Yeah, thank you. That's really powerful. Do you have any thoughts, final thoughts on where you would like to see perhaps these understandings of disability, but also farming and, you know, these indigenous knowledge systems thriving in rural India in maybe 5 or 10 years' time? Any kind of visions of where you'd like the future of this space to be?
Yes, definitely. So I wanted to see a world where every species given an equal respect and equal opportunity. And that equal opportunity is possible through natural farming practices and, you know, making people to realize the value of their own village and life around them and human relationships with animal relationships. And disability, as you said earlier, must be seen, ecology kind of a concept should be put in place, and it's not just disability ecology, it is the human and ecology kind of a system, which could be a wonderful model. And I do hope that given the conditions in which the economies are collapsing in the world, I think governments and industries are also coming forward to see how they reset the whole economy systems and what are the opportunities that we have in that economy system. For example, what kind of structures that you imagine for renewable energy and agriculture, and that particularly in agriculture, integrated agroforestry models, and then what are the transport systems, and what are the ancillary industry that is coming, and what are the trainings that you require to, adapt to the conditions in the process of urbanization, and also look back in your own in your own village systems where, your life is more integral to the ecological system that you have, and what kind of ecosystems are required, and what is it that government is coming forward with new ideas, new policies, new laws, and what is the stake, what are the stakes that we have as persons with disabilities, and also as part of the community of human beings and communities of life around us, and how does one really bring in that concept into the policy and your media and your social relationships, and look at a kind of a wealthy, regenerative, sustainable livelihoods for us and future generations.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a really powerful vision, tying it all together. Pavan, thank you so much for your time and insights. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for asking all pertinent questions. I hope that it is useful to you and it is useful for people who listen to this.
Please help us spread the word about Enabling Commons. Share it with a friend or link to it in your organization's newsletter. With thanks to Rose Pequet for producing transcripts and podcast promotion. The music is composed and produced by Sam Morgan. Audio production and hosting is by me, Anya Kelly Costello. To find out more about the intersections of disability and climate change, visit disabilityinclusiveclimate.org.